Okay, so we are here to talk about lab-grown wheat. Of course, we'll have to start by, as I did actually, by figuring out what exactly lab-grown meat is. And it's a really, really fascinating topic. I must admit that when I didn't think it would be as interesting when I first put it down. It's sort of one of those things that looks very sort of snazzy as a title. And I wasn't initially convinced that there was going to be a huge amount to talk about. And actually, the more that I've gone into it, it really, really, there's lots and lots and lots to say. We're definitely not going to be able to cover everything this evening. And the truth is, it is obviously a very much emerging topic. So actually, we'll start from that point, which is that one of my sort of starting points for my research was actually, I sort of have these collections of books and interesting things, you know, not all of which I've necessarily gone through. So I decided to flick through some of the stuff that I had. So I have a little bit of a series called The Journal of Contemporary Halacha, very, very good series, all sorts of interesting English articles on various areas of contemporary halacha, believe it or not. So I sort of flicked through, saw if I found anything on this topic, and I actually found an article from 2007 called Power of Meat by a Rabbi Daniel Friedman. So I spent, this is a few weeks ago, so I spent Shabbat flicking through it, and then I sort of looked, obviously Daniel Friedman, a relatively common Jewish name, believe it or not, and then I looked at the front, you know, about the author, And I came to the conclusion, actually, it's the rabbi who is currently in Hapsagot and Sabah, right? So this was now 13 years ago. He wrote this. Obviously, he wasn't there at the time. But he wrote this. So I sent him a message after Shabbat, said I enjoyed the article very much. Very, very interesting stuff. And he messaged me back and told me that when he wrote about it, and it's true, actually, I sort of, you know, you look into it, 2007, I don't know what made him write about it in 2007. No one else was talking about this stuff. Then very, very few people. It was real science fiction in 2007, like real sort of prehistoric in lab meat terms. But he did also point me in the direction of, it's interesting how this sort of ends up in the United Synagogue, is Rabbi Koenigsberg, who's the rabbi of Magen Avot, one of the United Synagogues, one of the small United Synagogues in Hendon, is actually an expert on this topic, which I didn't realize. So I've started to read. He sent me all sorts of really, really interesting stuff, which I'm happy to forward on afterwards. He's been interviewed on podcasts. He's got all sorts of articles out there. He's got lots of great stuff. So if you're interested in more material after this, Rabbi Koenigsberg has sent me a lot of things, and I'm happy to send it round. And he has been also very interestingly involved in, well, we'll come back to actually some of the things that he's been involved in as we go through. So why don't we kick off with a little bit about meat, okay, and its relevance for halacha. But as I said, really in practical terms, they only really begun to produce it in the last 5 or so years. And even then, it's not really available. I believe it has now been served in a restaurant in Singapore or something. And that's sort of, you know, big news that it has been now served in a restaurant in Singapore. So that's so just to show you how new this is. Okay. So, of course, in a sense, we are answering two questions this evening. Number one, is it meaty? And number two, is it kosher? Or really, we should do them in the opposite order, which is, in fact, the order we're probably going to look at. Is it kosher? Is it meaty? Right? So the first one is obviously to make sure it's kosher, and then to figure out whether we can have ice cream after. So as I said, first we need to begin by talking about what exactly lab meat is. Okay? So now, lab meat, so this is the definition from Wikipedia, and the reason I took it as the first line from Wikipedia, because it's already a mistake at the very beginning. I'm sure they've corrected themselves, or someone has corrected, you know, I'm sure it becomes a bit more corrected. But what the way they begin by defining it is cultured meat, and it has different names. Yes, lab meat, cultured meat. Some people call it clean meat. It's got all sorts of interesting names. But basically, it is meat that is produced by in vitro cell culture of animal cells instead of from slaughtered animals. So that instead of from slaughtered animals is an interesting place to start. While it's true that most of the sources of the sort of original cells are taken from non-slaughtered animals, it is possible and potentially from a kosher perspective necessary which we'll have to discuss a little bit later on, to take these cells from a slaughtered animal as well. So we'll start by getting rid of that. So, okay, so but in principle, okay, lab meat is basically lab meat that is grown effectively in a lab. It is grown, it sort of multiplies. You begin with the cells from the animal, and it multiplies in order to create what you see in front of you, which is a, you know, regular looking piece of meat, except for the fact that it looks quite scientific with the gloves around it. As I said, cells from the animal, and most often it's grown in a culture growth medium. They had there are lots of great terms that they use for this. There was another one where they talked about it as I can't remember, biological fluid or something. Whatever the term is that people come up with for these sorts of things, it grows inside something which enables the cells to grow at a very, very fast rate in order to create this meat. And again, to clarify, what that means is it's very different to, and you can get all of these as well, right, to things like artificial meat, you know, meat made from soy, genetically modified meat, again, not the same thing. Power of meat, okay, maybe this is, maybe this is not. But again, you can have, obviously, meat straight from the animal. You can have plant-based meat, which, again, is not what this is. This is, we're talking about cultured meat, which is taken from animal stem cells. So it definitely comes from an animal, definitely linked to an animal. But again, most often that animal is alive, and the meat is then grown in a laboratory or somewhere else, and finally ends up as a piece of meat. Okay, so that's a little bit about the background. Okay. Now, who is making this stuff, right? Are there any companies that are doing this? It's a growing industry. Okay, this infographic is a little bit outdated, but you can see that it's a big industry. And as I said, it's a growing industry. So this is the amount of money that they raised, as, you know, as startups do, which is, to me, seems a tremendous amount of money. So obviously there is a lot of money being poured into this industry, but it is a future industry. There's no real produce or practical produce that's actually coming out. There's no real market for it being sold, but there is obviously a great, great market and growing market for it to be produced. They say here that at the end of 2019, there was 55. I'm reliably told that there are now over 80 companies across the world who are producing this. And there are lots of different, not just different ways of doing it, but lots of different types of things, of course, that they are trying to do. So they're doing beef, chicken, okay, those we're familiar with, okay, pork, shrimp, probably not going to be, or what we'll have to discuss, right, but would those be kosher, would those not? You could certainly make an argument, not convinced practically, conclusively that that will be true, but certainly you can concoct a halakhic argument that even the lab-grown pork or shrimp potentially could be kosher. Okay. I'll just do one more slide and then we'll pause for questions, because I think it's also great to note that three of the leading brands who are doing this are based in Israel. You can look them up. They've each got very interesting websites with, again, all sorts of information and things from these particular companies who are producing this. Okay, let's come back to how to any questions before we go. Okay, great. So far, so simple. So as I said, so the cells are taken from the animal. Well, assume for now that the animal is alive. You take it from, a little bit of a few cells taken out of the animal, microscopic amount of cells, okay, and then put into, as we said, into some sort of culture, into some medium which enables them to grow. And they do not, as you said, they do not come back in contact with an animal again. So that is that. Once it's removed from the animal, it does stay in that environment, in this lab environment, until it makes its way to a restaurant or wherever it will be. But biologically, this is meat, right? If you look at it under a microscope and you put a regular steak next to it, you will not be able to tell, in principle, the difference between the two, right? The two will be identical. So you have meat from an animal that grew in a field, etc., and you have this meat from the animal that grew in the lab. They will be identical under a microscope, and that is really the key, or at least one of the key differences between this and obviously fake meat, soy meat, all those different types of things, which may taste more or less a little bit like meat, but ultimately are not. This very much is meat from that perspective. And just to clarify that this really, I've only chosen one, perhaps the most common sort of way in which they are produced, right? And obviously the question of whether or not this meat is kosher will depend significantly on the process, on the source of the cells, on the process that it goes through. And so therefore, I can very much conceive of a scenario where certain companies will be producing kosher lab meat and certain companies will not be producing kosher lab meat. So again, we will still end up with this industry. It won't necessarily be a blanket guarantee in any sense. Okay, so again, this is another great infographic. The reason I included this one as well, again, slightly different process and slightly different way of doing this, but again, this comes from this Israeli company, from Supermeat. So this is the way that they do it. They are producing their chicken, taken from the live chicken, all the way to this now brand new piece of chicken, which can be eaten. Why would we want to eat this? Okay, why would we want to eat this? That's what someone asked me today, actually. You know, why would you want to have any of this? So from an environmental perspective, it's unquestionably better, right? As you can see over here from a very simple thing, producing particularly with beef, when we're talking about beef, right? We're talking about now this is a pound, I think this is used per pound of meat. You can see there's massive usage of resources across the world that goes into producing beef, and this cuts that down enormously. So you can see again the comparison between animal-based meat and lab-grown meat, and again, in theory, it's effectively the same thing once it ends up on your plate. Again, leaving aside the kosher question, but just from a sort of a food perspective, it seems to be the same thing when it comes to your plate. Why aren't we on eating this now? Well, for the very simple reason that although the price is coming down pretty regularly, it's still very, very, very expensive at the moment. I believe that the first burger that was produced, unless I'm mistaken, was actually partially eaten by Steve Jobs, cost $300,000, right? So the first burger that was produced is a seriously expensive lab-grown burger. Now, again, the price has probably gone down to about $12, which you could probably buy a cooked burger for in a restaurant, but we're talking about here just the raw meat itself is going to be per pound $12. So that's still very expensive and not quite market ready yet, but I definitely think we're heading in that direction. Again, an industry that's moving very, very quickly and an industry that is going to become increasingly relevant as the years go. Okay, and this actually was a picture, I believe, of the not with the flag in the top, but of the first burger that was produced. All right, any questions, thoughts, comments before we jump into some of the sources and the sort of more halakhic discussion? Okay, great. People should be able to just unmute themselves if they want. Okay, so a crucial question, is it kosher? So I did actually initially split it up between is it kosher and is it meaty. In the end, I think it's easier to just sort of deal with it as one whole unit, and we will obviously touch on both of them as we go through it. So we'll take on quite a big chunk now. Obviously, the bulk of what we're going to talk about, feel free to unmute and ask questions during this time if you do have any, and I'll try and stop to give time as well. All right, so the first one is, why should the Torah have anything to say about it at all? Okay, so I just think it's important to clarify this as a principle. We're not going to spend time on this because this, again, could be a whole sort of topic in and of itself, but there's obviously no line in the Torah that talks about whether or not lab meat is meaty or kosher or anything like that, because obviously this technology was something that we developed long after we received the Torah. But part of our belief system is, of course, that the Torah has given us principles. The Torah is everlasting, right? And the Torah, in a sense, gives us principles which we're able to adapt and apply to all different scenarios. And all we could, again, this could be a separate, very, very fascinating shiur where we can go through, or series, in fact, where we can go through the ways in which various new topics have, in fact, been dealt with from a halakhic perspective. Really, really fascinating to be able to see how you know, major halakhic authorities plug in the various aspects into modern technologies. Classic examples of things like electric lights on Shabbat. Of course, a lot of fertility issues, IVF, all those sorts of things, and things which we've discussed, 30, 40 years ago as well. And of course, more recently, there's been lots of great discussions over the last year as well about Zoom and how it applies to Megillah, to Kaddish, all these sorts of different things. And again, these are about applying the principles, about going back to the sources, to sort of drawing out the key elements and being guided to sort of be able to plug them in to the sort of modern scenarios that we find ourselves in as well. And so all of the sources that I'm really presenting here are not sources that I, run around and find myself. These are sources that, in a sense, that halakhic authorities are giving credence to, or saying these are, in a sense, the sources that are relevant to this topic, the sources that one needs to go through in order to grasp and in order to further understand this topic. Okay, so great, really, really fascinating source. I've always enjoyed these sorts of more unusual sources. And again, when we have these sorts of Gemara, which talk about things which are clearly not things which happen in our world, let's put it like that, the point is not the facts of the Gemara, whether they happen, whether they didn't happen, or anything like that. But in a sense, it's, as I said, we're distilling down the elements to take out of this. So the Gemara itself, of course, has a discussion about, and I'll give the background in a moment, but it ends up having a discussion about a very, very similar thing, potentially. So again, this everyone who is talking about lab meat discusses this Gemara. Some of them say this Gemara is just like lab meat. Most actually conclude that this Gemara is very different to lab-grown meat. So let's get into it ourselves in just a moment. So the Gemara begins by talking about, actually, before we get to this part, I've only taken a small section, of course, talks about brings a source that discusses Adam and Eve eating meat. Now, of course, we know that one of the prohibitions, they were not allowed to eat the animals in the Garden of Eden, they weren't allowed to eat meat. And so again, the Gemara discusses where exactly did meat come from. And I suggest maybe it came from heaven. Then it says, what do you mean meat coming from heaven? There's such thing as meat coming from heaven. Meat ikra, and that's where our Gemara picks up. Meat ikra basar hayuridin hashamayim. How do you have such a thing as meat coming from heaven? It says, yeah, of course, we have meat coming from heaven. So the Hotter of Shimon ben Chalafta, there's a story about Reb Shimon ben Chalafta. He was walking along. These two lions came to get him, right? These lions were sort of ready to eat him up. And in order, so a miracle was performed in a sense to help him out, that rather than having to eat these lions, rather than the lions ending up eating him, there was meat that was sent down from heaven. This meat sort of dropped out of nowhere, these two big, large chunks of meat. And the lions ended up going for the meat instead of for him. But even better than that, what happened? They got filled up with just one, right? They didn't want both of the pieces of meat. The lions actually only wanted one of these slabs of meat. And then that was enough for them. And then they left, and that was it. So he was left with the other one. So now he's got this big chunk of meat sitting in front of him, right? Came out of heaven. And he runs off to the Bet Midrash with this piece of meat. He'll never guess what happens, he says. Look at this piece of meat coming out of heaven. Right, is it kosher or is it not kosher? That's what he wants to know. Asal Abim Drasha, Boy Allah, he asked them all, Davar Tamehu Zeh, or Davar Tamar. Is it kosher or is it non kosher? Omar Lay, Ein Davar Tameh Yored Min Hashemayim. And their conclusion is, it's impossible. So you think you have good Hechsherim in Babylon, you think you have good kashrut authorities in London in 21st century, there is no better Hechsher in the world than the stamp from heaven. If it came down from heaven, must be kosher. That is real, that's a real Hechsher, right? So that's what they said. It's impossible that non-kosher meat would fall from heaven. Okay, so again, whether or not whatever the relevance of the source in terms of the practicalities, if you type in meat falling from the sky, meat fell from the sky in Kentucky about 200 years ago or something, and there's all sorts of explanations for why exactly that happened, or not, vultures and whatever, yeah, anyway. So So, but the point is that we have our Gemara talks about meat coming from heaven. Just make sure that these people can get in. Okay. So as I said, the Gemara talks about meat coming from heaven. The conclusion of the Gemara is that no, if it came from heaven, then it must be kosher, right? Now, you can look at this Gemara and say, oh, just like, lab meat is a similar thing, right? In a sense, this doesn't come from an animal. Here we have the Gemara talking about meat that doesn't come from an animal. And we have meat that, in a sense, doesn't come from an animal, right? Seems to obviously it doesn't appear miraculously, but seems to materialize without actually growing as an animal. So potentially, sounds like you might say that yes, okay, if it comes from heaven, then it's all good. But actually, if it doesn't come from heaven, then maybe not so good at all. But I say most, almost all the poskim who bring this actually use this in the opposite direction and say that the point over here is that this is something which is made, in a sense, miraculously, right? This is made clearly not coming from an animal at all, clearly not coming from anything whatsoever. But in our case, we absolutely know that it comes from an animal, right? This is not something which has just materialized out of nowhere. It's not something which has come out of nothing, right? We very much have an original source for this. We know exactly where it came from. Yes, it was cells. Yes, it was small, which we'll come back to, but in principle, what we see is that if it is materializing, even if it doesn't come directly from an animal, at least at the beginning, it does seem to be that it would need to have some sort of kosher sort of source. As I said, that's a Gemara which everyone discusses, although most say that it, in a sense, is very, very different to lab grown meat. All right, any questions before we go on? Okay, so when we're talking about lab meat, as I said before, there are multiple ways to do this. And again, we could spend a long time going through all of the different I didn't obviously have a chance to go through all of the different companies and how they do it, but there are a number of different origins of where they take the meat from, and B, the process that they use in order to actually form it into a usable piece of meat. And both of those things are obviously very, very significant, and as I said at the beginning, will change the halacha. Right, many, many times we have people will take but on a very, very regular basis, people will say that a certain halacha, you sort of take a line, let's say, out of the Shulchan Aruch, and you say, oh, you see that the halacha is X, Y, Z, but actually in different circumstances with different what we call mitziyot, right, different sort of practical realities, that it applies in a different way. So yes, when we're going to talk about bittul nullification, when we're going to talk about microscopic organisms, when we're going to talk about all those sorts of different things, yes, all of those elements are critical, but actually applying them to the different facts on the ground and the different realities in the way that this meat is made will make all the difference. And therefore, as I said, these two elements, I want us to sort of keep them in mind as we go through this entire thing. What is the origin of this, and what is the process that it goes through? So first, was the origin kosher, and then does the process, in a sense, help us or hurt us? Does it hinder us in any way when deciding if this is kosher or not? So when we talk about the origin, of the cells, you can again take this in three different directions. Okay, well, so let's say, for instance, you take cells from from a pig, to use a different example. Okay, let's say you want to take the cells from a pig, right, and you want to then grow those into a piece of meat. Maybe we could argue that that is kosher. So in one sense, you can actually argue. Okay, because when you take the original cells, when you look at that source material, you can either say that what it that sort of tiny cell, and these, all of this is found in, as I said, found in halakhic authorities, and we'll go through it step by step. You can either say that those source materials are irrelevant, and therefore, wherever you're taking it from, now that you've grown it into something new, this item was grown in a laboratory, therefore this item is grown in a laboratory, you know, laboratory is not an animal, it's something totally different, and therefore it's irrelevant where it came from. You could treat it as the halakhic category of something which is derived from meat. Okay, now something which is derived from meat does not have the status of meat, but is considered to be kosher if it comes from a kosher animal. So for instance, right, the obvious obvious things are something like an egg, right? An egg is what's called in halakha yotze min ha-tahor tahor, yotze min ha-tameh tameh. If it comes from a kosher bird, it's considered to be derived, it's considered to come out of a kosher animal, and therefore it would be a kosher egg, but not meaty. Or if you take it from a non-kosher bird, then again, that egg would not be kosher. Other example, of course, is milk, right? Milk from a kosher animal is considered to be kosher. Milk from a non-kosher animal is not considered to be kosher. And that's what we call yotze min ha-tahor, something which is derived from something kosher. And in this case, you could potentially say that this is not meat, it's derived from meat. So what would that mean? That would mean practically that if it's derived from meat, it would have to be taken from a kosher animal, but the substance itself, this burger that you end up with, wouldn't be meaty, right? Wouldn't be meaty because it's, in a sense, removed from the animal. It's no longer part of the animal. It would be more similar to an egg than it would be to meat that comes from the animal itself. Or third option is that we say this is like the meat itself. Again, this is animal, and that's exactly what how we're going to treat it in halakhic terms. Okay, so now let's really we'll spend most of the time sort of trying to analyze each of these, and we'll go through them one at a time. Okay, any questions before we go on? All right. There we go. Ignore that. So number one, we could say it's irrelevant. Okay, now the source for being able to say this, or the source that sort of proponents of this, again, I wouldn't say there's major halakhic proponents of this, but as I said, if we're concocting a halakhic argument, you know, you can definitely do this, and I think it's interesting to consider at least. There is a very, very significant principle in halakha called lon nitna hatara l'malachei hasharet, that the Torah is not given to angels, okay? Not given to miraculous beings, and actually something which is undetectable to a human being is not considered to be relevant in halakha. So, for instance, one of the examples, one of the ways in which this is applied is that Aruch HaShulchan famously says that Aruch HaShulchan lived at the turn of the 20th century, and you know, technology obviously was developing at that time, and you could see inside water or inside something you know, similar, that actually there are tiny little microbes inside that water. Now, we have a principle that you're not allowed to eat any in halakha, you're not allowed to ingest any bugs or anything like that, right? No creepy crawlers, you're not allowed to eat any of them. Now, if this water is full of microbes, right, or full of tiny little things inside it, then maybe you're not allowed to drink water, right? So how exactly do you deal with that? The Aruch HaShulchan says very simply, you don't see them, they're minuscule, microscopic. Anything that's microscopic, anything which cannot be seen by a human eye, which is in a sense is not relevant from a halakhic perspective. Now again, that principle is not questioned. Everyone agrees to that principle. The question of how we apply that principle is something which we have to be careful in doing. And Rav Shlomo Zalman, who again is writing, this is now decades before lab-grown meat, but he already clarifies that, okay, when we talk about something when we're talking about microbes, yes, that's true, that anything which is smaller than, you know, cannot be seen by a human eye is not relevant to halakha. One second. I'm just gonna give me one moment. Sorry. back. We're back. Right. Door's closed. Yes. So Rosh Hashanah Zalman, as I said, clarifies that if you're using these, if you're able to manipulate these microbes, if you are using them in a sense intentionally, then that is no longer something which is not detectable by human beings. Yes, it's true that if I, you know, let's say if you were to take this glass of water and put it under a microscope, you would find all sorts of interesting things inside it. Okay, but I can't see them here. But if you are intentionally taking something and using that, manipulating it scientifically, that is already something that is detectable by human. Yes, it may be the same size. In fact, it may be even smaller. But what the fact that you are, in a sense, are now able to utilize this and use it for your own benefit already makes it something which is no longer, you know, no longer falls into this principle of the Torah is not given to angelic beings, to sort of beings who can perform miracles, because this is not miracles. This is now something which is in the realm of science. And actually, I think it's a really fascinating, again, you could spend time delving into this further, but in principle, I think this is a really, really fascinating source, because what it's, or you know, the way I read it, is it's sort of telling you that, in a beautiful way, maybe I like this from a scientific perspective, but in a sense, science is miraculous. But in a sense, once it becomes science, then that is something that's sort of, it's different to classic, to classic sort of angelic miracles, but because it's now in our hands, it's now something which we are able to do. So yes, I could use a microscope to look into this water, but that's not relevant. I mean, that's not something which I'm trying to do on a regular basis. But once I sort of do manipulate that, once I do get involved in that, and in this case, to apply that to the lab room meat, to say that we are taking these cells, and because they're microscopic, so that's, you know, that's not relevant to this. So yes, in principle, that might be true. But once you are now using those cells to then grow the meat, that is the very, very source from which you are creating this entire substance is based on those same cells. Then that argument is no longer relevant. And therefore, as I said, I don't know anyone who in practical terms suggests that the cells are totally irrelevant, that you can literally take pig cells and make a kosher piece of pork from that. But as I said, you can see someone concocting such an argument, but in practical terms, I don't think anyone actually argues that in practice. All right. So that's, as I said, that's one way that we could view these cells. Okay. Any thoughts before we go on? All right. The second way to do it is to say that these cells are taken from an animal, and as we said before, like an egg is taken from an animal or comes out of an animal, these cells are now removed from the animal. They're no longer animal per se. Therefore, they do have to come from a kosher animal, or potentially they have to come from a kosher animal. Let's start from that one. So obviously, if we're going to say that these are coming from an animal, then they do have to come from a kosher animal. Now, at first glance, that shouldn't be too difficult, right? Okay, all you need to do is take a cow instead of a pig. The problem is that there's another Torah prohibition that we're also not allowed to eat a limb or flesh from a live animal, right? So you're not allowed to eat a limb or flesh from a live animal that is taken from a live animal. So that means even if the animal is killed afterwards, again, no longer allowed, that meat itself is forbidden, it's prohibited. So now we have here the beginnings of a relatively significant problem, perhaps the most significant problem, actually, and I don't think there's a great conclusion on this at the moment, but as I said, it's not in restaurants yet, so I'm sure we'll figure something out. But in principle, this is perhaps the most significant problem, although we will suggest a couple of different potential ways around this. As I said, this prohibition of ever min ha-chai, of taking a limb or taking flesh from a live animal, is significant. Not because this is causing the animal any pain. You're taking a limb from a live animal. Yes, it's true that the, you know, in a sense, the reason for that prohibition is probably because of cruelty. But once we have a prohibition, that prohibition applies even once the reasoning doesn't necessarily. The Torah prohibition is the Torah prohibition. We follow the commandment because because they are the commandments. And therefore, if we're going to say this is yotze min ha-tahor, tahor, that something which is derived from a kosher animal would be kosher, but something which is not, this does derive from a prohibition. Or this, the prohibition is not to take it, but this does derive from something which would be prohibited to eat. Right? Those cells would be prohibited to consume. And therefore, that that will be a problem. That would be a problem. As I said, we do have to try and figure something out on that front. I don't have great suggestions here, but let's go through a couple of the suggestions that, that people have. So number one is what I put here is panim chadashot. So this is a very, very fascinating, again, you could do a whole topic on this itself, which is as follows. That some argue, nothing to do with lab-grown meat. Again, all of these arguments predate lab-grown meat, all sorts of other interesting topics. So this actually has become very controversial and very famous because of gelatin. This argument was used with regards to gelatin, and is still something which is heavily argued, depending on who you follow. And that is as follows, that once something is so so changed, so significantly changed from what it originally was, then it is what we call a panim chadashot ba'u lekan. It's like a new face, it's like a new identity, almost takes on a new identity. And once it's been so totally, totally changed, so totally, totally shifted from what it originally was, then it is no longer considered to be the same substance, and therefore I would not be considered to be the same thing. So Rav Avadia Yosef, great, great Sephardi halachic authority, famously stressed that this is true of gelatin, right? So actually, he would permit, and still, well, not him, but you know, many rely on the opinion that while this type of gelatin may be derived from something which is not necessarily kosher, once it's been ground down, totally reconstituted, totally sort of so significantly removed from what it originally was, from that original animal, that it was, but actually that gelatin would be okay. And there are many, so many of the jelly sweets in Israel will be produced with this sort of gelatin, but others obviously don't follow that. There are many who disagree with that, and who say that once you, yes, in principle that's true, but once you then recreate it, This is really linked to chametz on Pesach as well. Okay, so it's linked to chametz on Pesach. Once chametz is so removed from being edible, then it's no longer considered chametz. Yes, that's true. But then once you put it back into something which makes it edible, then that's a much, much harder thing to argue. So that's what the sort of counter argument is. That yes, you have this panim chadashot ba'u lekan, but then you've put it back in a sense. So you take these cells. Yes, they look nothing like meat. Yes, they're totally different. Yes, you put them into this culture, and if you were to show someone this petri dish, they would tell you this isn't a piece of beef. It doesn't look anything like a piece of meat, doesn't smell like a piece of meat, just totally different. But once you then make a piece of meat out of this, so that's again, that's in a sense the counter argument. So this is a suggestion, very significant suggestion, not to be sneered at. There are very significant halakhic authorities who follow this. But as I said, it's still something which is highly, highly debated nowadays, and many don't agree with this. I see we have a question, and I'll generally pause for other questions at this point. Yes.
Just a small diversion, that panim chadashot argument, does that apply to rennet in cheese? Is that an argument that people have...
Rennet in cheese is a different thing altogether. Rennet in cheese is what's called a dover hamma'amit. Okay, well, it's actually... Oh, let's come back to that. Let's come back to rennet in cheese in a minute. That's the next part, really. Okay, any other questions?
Rabbi, may I ask a question?
Sure. Or
is there any... Can we get any assistance from the fact that we can eat some substances that come from unkosher animals? That is to say, we can eat honey from bees, from honeybees, and that we can also eat a substance that comes from an animal that is a clean animal, but we can't really say it's a kosher animal until it's been shechted, but it hasn't been shechted because it's a cow that's living and it's giving milk. I think that isn't the rule that we can eat milk something that's derived rather than expressed in the Torah? There's nothing There's nothing that directly says that you can eat milk from a cow. Indirectly, we know that you must be able to consume milk because you're not supposed to see the kid in its mother's milk. But there's nothing that directly says that you can eat milk. Plus, there's nothing that tells us why it's not meaty, given that it comes from an animal. It's certainly not a plant. So is there anything that we can learn from either of those examples?
I see. Okay, yes. I'm sorry, you lost me with the second one for a bit, and then I think I found you again. So in terms of the bee, we're going to leave the bee aside because the Gemara has a whole discussion as to why you're allowed to consume honey, and it's very specific to the process and to the way in which honey is made, which is not relevant to this. But what I think you're saying is that, for instance, milk, yes. So I'm sitting here telling a story saying that eggs have to come from a kosher animal and milk has to come from a kosher animal. But these cells which have to come from a kosher animal, if they come from a live animal, then that's no good. But the milk also comes from a live animal, and the eggs also come from a live animal. So surely that's no longer relevant. So yes, you're right. Sorry. So I should have clarified that. That is probably the best argument, actually. Because, as I said, a lot of this other stuff is going to be subject to debate. The challenge with that argument is gonna fall down on sort of the next part. Is really to what extent you consider this meat and to what extent you consider it derived from meat, basically. So yes, you're right. In principle, if this is something which is really derived from meat and no longer at all relevant to that, no longer considered to be meat whatsoever, then yes, perhaps it would be more similar to an egg and therefore wouldn't necessarily need to come from an animal that had shechita done to it. So we'll leave that there. I think it's a very good point. Sorry, thank you for clarifying it, and I think it is an important point to raise. As I said, we're not going to reach any really good conclusion at the moment because this is still a topic that's very much under debate. But thank you for raising that. So as Phil says, similar to eggs and milk, not requiring the animal to be slaughtered before we eat those eggs or milk, then again, one could make a similar argument with regards to this to these cells which are removed. Okay, I'm not going to get into that. Okay, there is a whole interesting discussion anyway about milk, there's a whole separate sort of topic as to using, figuring out whether these dairy cows are healthy enough as a concept of what's called a trefa, which means that actually a walking living cow can be considered to be non-kosher because it is not well, because it's very unwell. So for instance, you know, famously adhesions in the lungs and things like that. So yes, it will. So that is a big discussion when it comes to milk, and potentially could be a very, very relevant discussion when it comes to taking the cells of this animal for its meat as well. But that's already a whole big topic regarding majorities and things like that, you know, percentages and figuring out how many of these cows are likely to be kosher or non-kosher. Very, very interesting topic, which requires much more in-depth discussion. Okay, any other points? Okay, so the only other element we could add, and this is again suggested by, I'll say it's, unless I'm mistaken, it is suggested by someone who, one of the early writers of a discussion on this topic, not a halachic authority, but someone who is well-versed, you know, someone who's a very, very interesting, researcher, wealthy businessman from LA, who likes to write on all sorts of interesting topics, very, very well-researched things. And again, he's suggested a few of these different suggestions. And one of them is this idea of bittul, okay, which is something which we talked about a couple of weeks ago in our first topic, in our first shiur, when we talked about We talked about meat and milk and all those sorts of things. So bittul is something which is very, very important in halacha. We apply it all the time. We use the concept of bittul. And bittul basically means nullification or the overpowering effectively of a significant majority. So in this case, one could say that the cells of the animal are taken and put into this dish. Now, most of the time, if not all of the time, but I think at least most of the time, if you come back to one of the earlier slides, you'll have seen that actually the cell culture, that the sort of the medium in which the cells grow is plant-based. Okay, that is plant-based. And seeing as that is plant-based and obviously is much, much more significant, the volume of that liquid, much, much larger than the cells that are put inside it, you could say that the cells which are then put inside that become butter, become nullified within that larger amount. So, for instance, right, if you, again, classic example of bittul, which we've raised in the past, if you're cooking a large amount of soup, you can be chillant and accidentally you spill a drop of milk into it. So as long as that milk is less than 1/60th of the large pot, then the food would still be kosher. So we might say the same thing. So as long as the cells are, microscopic, they are, which they are, they're less than 1/60th of the culture, which they are, then bittul is what is taking place here, that there's some sort of nullification which happens. This, I must say, while it sounds, and I think he would say this himself, it sounds like a really good argument. And again, you can sort of fit it into a lot of the, it seems to go well, but it falls down on a number of different areas, a number of different areas of bittul itself actually sort of has its own limitations, right? And has its own parameters. And one of them, for instance, is that bittul only works, actually it comes back a little bit to what my father mentioned before about rennet. So rennet is what is called a davar hamamit. Now rennet into cheese, the Gemara originally suggests potentially could be a case of bittul, that you have milk being curdled by a tiny, tiny amount of rennet, right? Tiny, tiny amount of rennet. But the rennet is animal based. Shouldn't that be a problem? So there we have what we call a davar hamamid. In that particular case, you have something which is causing the entire process to take place, right? Causing the entire process to actually happen. The cheese would not materialize. This milk would not curdle in the same way if it were not for that product. If it were not for that element within it, and therefore that. In that particular scenario, bittul cannot take place. You cannot nullify something which is so significant, even if it's tiny, even if it's minuscule, even if it's clearly overpowered from a volume perspective, from a significance perspective, it is causing this entire reaction to take place, and therefore it would be considered a davar hamamid. I think that we should say the same thing here, right, with regards to the meat, right? So yes, the meat is tiny. Yes, the cells are minuscule when they're put into this culture. But in a sense, that's the whole goal. This entire piece is being created from these original cells. Some have used a slightly different, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel was one of the sort of most significant religious Zionist halakhic authorities in Israel today, said a similar thing, but actually used a very, very interesting, slightly different proof, where he said that he said bittul is only relevant, this nullification is only relevant when you are where you have two different things. So yes, there is a culture here, but what you end up with at the end is the exact same substance multiplied over. And the proof that he brought, very, very interesting proof, is that is from Hanukkah, right? It's from Hanukkah that actually there's a very interesting question a number of the commentaries ask when it comes to Hanukkah, which is that the menorah, of course, famously burnt with oil that on which a miracle was performed, right? There seems to be miraculous oil. So very interesting. Some of the commentaries say, what do you mean it was miraculous oil? You can't, the Torah doesn't say you can light the menorah in the temple with miraculous oil. You have to light it with olive oil. The oil has to come from an olive, not from a miracle, right? If you're producing this oil from nothing, then it should no longer, then it shouldn't work. The entire thing shouldn't have worked altogether. What the answer is the following, is that when you have something which is, the miracle wasn't that the oil was produced out of nothing. The miracle was that the oil multiplied. So you started with the olive oil, and it grew in a sense. It you know, became more, or it lasted longer. It, in a sense, was able to stretch out further than it should have done otherwise. It says the same thing over here. That you start out with these cells of meat, it is still meat, but it sort of, in a sense, stretches out further than it would originally. He said that's not bitter, okay? That's not, he's not talking about it from a miraculous perspective, but just pointing out that the idea of nullification here is not relevant, he says. The idea of nullification cannot be relevant when you start with one particular substance and you end up with a larger amount of the same substance. That, he says, is just simply the same substance multiplied over, and therefore you would have to start again. The point of this here is that you would have to start with the kosher animal. As Phil points out, potentially could still be alive, but the animal itself certainly would have to be kosher. It could not be a non-kosher animal, which we are starting with according to these arguments. Okay, so that's number two. I'll pause for questions at the end because we're nearly there. So we'll just end up by with the final thing, which is, and the reason I've put this quote in is because Rabbi Koenigsberg told me very interestingly that when he that he actually went, I think, to one of the factories or to one of the labs with Rav Osher Weiss, who's also one of the great halakhic authorities of Israel today. Very, very fascinating person. Comes to London actually semi-regularly. Well worth hearing. Very, very interesting sage. And so when he was going around, he was asking lots of different questions. And actually, Rabbi Koenigsberg said that he really did start from the opposite direction. So whereas we've been talking about figuring out whether this is kosher, and then we're going to discuss whether it's meat, his entire premise from the very beginning is trying to figure out whether this is halakhically meat or not. And his conclusion was a very simple one, which is that at the end of the day, he says, this is a piece of meat. So I think the phrase, if I remember correctly, that Rabbi Koenigsberg attributed to him was, he said, you know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it is a duck, effectively. You know, so he said that was his point over here. And once that is true, again, that works in a sense against us if we're looking for something that is parev, but it works in our favor in the kosher sense. So again, that's what he pointed out as well. That once we have, in a sense, in front of us a piece of meat from a cow, then that should work very well, assuming that again this is a kosher cow, that we don't have an issue with the shechita element, which is still a question. As I said, you know, one can definitely suggest, and in practical terms, I think that this is also something, again, I can send all these sources. There was also a great podcast to listen to on this topic from one of the senior authorities of the OU, which is, of course, I think, the biggest kashrut organization in the world. And he was also making a sort of a similar argument, a similar thing, that when we have something which is so clearly meat on every sort of level, you know, by every sort of definition, is going to end up being meat, then he said, from a halakhic perspective, then the same thing is going to be true, and this would be considered meat. Now, in conclusion, all right, we'll take a moment for questions, and then we'll just sort of wrap up briefly. Okay, so just to wrap up a little bit of what we said is that I think, as we said at the beginning, it's difficult to claim that there is, usually when you have these sorts of scenarios, like actually to take an example we mentioned earlier, so let's say electricity on Shabbat was an example which I said earlier, which was obviously discussed, you know, really significantly at the sort of the turn of the 20th century when it became relevant. Now, and was very interestingly debated, okay, so you had very legitimate opinions on both sides of the fence, you know, and sort of establishing whether electricity, how it works on Shabbat and how it works with Shabbat and all those sorts of things. For practical terms, now we have a much, much more established Pesach. There is a much, much more sort of consensus opinion. So again, now certain of the more fringe opinions have sort of fallen out of favor, as it were. You can't say the same thing in this regard. Okay? You can't say the same thing about lab meat because it's such a new topic. Okay, it's very difficult to say that there is any real sort of consensus on this topic. However, my particular, my personal sense is that I do get the sense that that this will need to come from a kosher animal and will be considered meat. As I said, you know, certainly that seems to be the leaning of a number of the Muslim authorities. However, I do note that my own Rosh Hashiva of Shechta actually disagreed. So Rosh Shechta did say that while it does need to come from a kosher animal, he didn't think it would be meat. He did feel it would be Arab. At least that was in his initial sort of analysis of the discussion. He thought it would be Parav, and that certainly seems very significant. However, again, just the final point, which is that, of course, a lot of this is based on our assumption that the cells are coming from a kosher animal. So one of the other questions that someone asked me just today, actually, was, you know, so once we're talking about lab-grown meat, so will you need supervision or anything like that, right? If it's grown in a lab, then it's grown in a lab. So yes, maybe that's true, but you would still, because the source is so significant, because the source may well be the key to its being kosher or not, we would need to have, yes, there would need to be still, you know, supervision in a sense on the original source of the cells, and to ensure that what is in the laboratory is actually being produced from those original cells and not being, you know, getting other animal cells in instead. So that's obviously still would be a very significant element. And then there's going to be loads and loads and loads more that's written and discussed about this over the years. But I also do think that it's something which is going to be, which is hopefully going to be a very, very positive development, you know, which is hopefully something which is going to, and again, this was really, in a sense, the end of the Kashrut series. But I also sort of want to link it to the beginning of, because we're running out of time to do the other one as well, to link to the beginning of a sort of a more eco series as well. And from an ecological perspective, as we mentioned at the beginning, this is also a very, very significant, hopefully positive development, something which will enable us to continue to, you know, to enjoy the benefits of these sorts of things, benefits of this world that the Almighty has given us, but in a way that's more sustainable and in a way that we're able to sort of continue to look after it and maintain it as well as utilizing it for our benefit. And I think that was really all I wanted to say on the topic. Any other questions or comments?
Yes, Rabbi. So picking up on your last point, actually, this is something I've been following for a few years. And the way I see it going, it's going to become, when the price comes down enough, it's going to become unconscionable for people to eat slaughtered meat. They will only eat manufactured meat. And that will probably happen just within one generation now. So that will mean things like the end of leather as a material that we use as well. So if things are happening that fast, how long does it take for a suck to be made on a topic like this?
Well, you don't, in a sense, you don't want it to be made, but you will always follow. Your question is, let's say there's no consensus, right? Who do you choose how to follow? That's really the question.
I guess if there are still differing opinions, yes, that may well be the question.
That's a very interesting question. That's a question of. I'll answer it simply by saying that the Mishnah seems to say that you should ask your rabbi. So that's the easy way out of it. But it is an interesting topic, as I said. You could. That's also sort of a broader interesting topic, as to when you have these big debates without seeming consensus. How exactly do we weigh up these different opinions and figure it out? Certainly, I would say that from a I would say that once something becomes consensus, I think you can legitimately say that somebody is wrong for following a minority opinion. I think you can, after the fact, I think it's, until there is a significant consensus, I think it's harder to make that argument, and that's fine. You know, that's legitimate. You have that in the Gemara, where the Gemara talks about the people in the area, you know, who lived in Bet Shammai's area would follow the opinion of Bet Shammai. Now, we nowadays, in almost all cases, follow the opinion of Bet Hillel. And nowadays, to follow the opinion of Bet Shammai would be the wrong thing to do in those sort of scenarios where we follow the opinion of Bet Hillel. But at the time, it would have in fact been wrong to do the opposite. You should be following Bet Shammai if he is the local law authority, and that was the thing. So I think there are definitely enough notable authorities who have weighed in on it. I'm actually, from a practical perspective, I'm not as convinced as you that it's coming so quickly, because I grew up, I grew up 20 years ago being told that petrol was on the way out and that flying cars were going to be coming in anytime soon, and I'm still waiting. So we'll see. I would love it to happen, yeah. But, and, you know, I think it'd be great to sort of move into these things. But, like, even now, you know, even as we move into, let's say, as the example, you know, electric cars, it's still going. It's like you say, it's the financial element which is still so significant to all of this, and I think will be part of the thing. I see you've sent a link out. We'll try and make that one up.
Yeah, that's Aleph Farms.
I actually saw this
announcing a steak, a proper steak product, although not a product yet.
Oh, so there you go. Oh yeah, I have seen this. I did see this.
Yeah.
Oh yes, which they right, which this was the bioprinted one, which I didn't. I meant to mention that actually. So again, that comes back to the process, as you said before. So the process I was talking about it growing in this cell culture. They've done it in a different way, where they've actually printed it with. They've used the materials to sort of print it in a 3D printer, 3D bioprinting. Again, it's just mind-boggling to think about it. But there you go. And I haven't found the other. So there's more consensus, or there are more opinions on the halachic side of it. What I was also interested in, but very hard to find any opinions on, is what it tastes like, because there are so few people who've actually eaten it. Very hard to find good opinions. I mean, obviously, the companies themselves all tell you it tastes fantastic. But I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to see.
There was an interesting thing actually that said that the same technology though might be used for medical purposes,
right?
Building replacement organs or skin grafts, or and I guess that brings up a whole other set of halakhic questions. If you're going to be able to use this technology in a different way to save lives, where that goes?
Yeah. Although I think that was already coming in with cloning. I think they'd already begun to do a little, I don't know. But yeah, I think that had already been discussed a bit more. That's a little bit easier to do, a little bit easier from a halakhic perspective. But yeah, please God, technology is a good way to hopefully solve a lot of these problems.
Well, Rabbi, as well, if it's meaty but hasn't been shefted, do you need to kasher it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, the only reason you kasher it is because of the blood. So I don't guess that depends on how much blood is in there. I don't know exactly. And again, you'd have to look into the practicalities of when it's made, how exactly they do that. So I don't know. That's a good question. Well, I'm writing that one down. If anyone's interested, I'm happy to send out the slides, as I said, or any other. Any other interesting stuff? All right, Robert Koenigsberg was on. He just sent it to me today, so I actually haven't listened to it. But he was on a podcast called, let me see if I find it here, called The Future Food Show a few days ago. It's about a 20-minute podcast on the Future Food Show. So again, you can listen into that. You know, where they talked to him about some of this basic stuff. Again, really, really fascinating. Watch this space. Lots more to come on this topic. And in terms of the eco series, I'm hoping that we will have a couple more coming as well. But it will be advertised as soon as possible. Okay. Any other questions?
Would you eat this meat? Do you think, Rabbi, if you were happy it was kosher?
Yeah. Why not?
I can't see any reason why not either.
Yeah.
Don't you get into this whole GM argument as well, don't you? And I think,
I don't think this is GM though.
Well, it's kind of related, isn't it? You've taken cells, cells, and you've played around with them. You've manipulated them, haven't you? And made them not quite what they were originally.
Yeah, I think the GM argument was more of a health argument, as or sort of like I was more worried about the GM side from less the sort of moral side of it and more of the We don't really know what we're doing to these sorts of things and what it's actually producing. I think this seems to be pretty much ending up as meat. I don't think that's a major halachic issue, personally. But yeah,
one less thing to worry about.
Yeah. So there you go. Looks very interesting. Looks very, very interesting. And as I said, it's great that that I think that Israel seems to be at the forefront of it. So.
While you're speculating about science coming up, I mean, there's no doubt with all the technology, and we see it with the vaccines even now, the manipulation of DNA, that there's no doubt they'll be able to manufacture, say, pig DNA from the raw molecules, insert it into a cell, and make artificial pork that would have been made totally from the bare constituents.
That's what this is, really.
No, but this is a cell. This is an already constituted beef cell, isn't it? That then.
Oh, so bred. Sorry. So actually, sorry. You remind me. There was. See, I apologise. There was another element that I meant to say, which is also there are two. They're already doing. They're taking the part of the animal they're taking is from are two different things as well. You'll forgive me about the lack of or the mistaken science if I mess it up. But they take. A lot of it's taken from muscle cells or from what they call the muscle stem cells. But then I think they can also take it from more embryonic stem cells. So it's not, but when it starts as muscle stem cells, that's again closer to meat. That is, muscle is obviously the meat itself. So those cells in a sense are small cells of meat. Whereas when it's taken from the earlier cells, then it's sort of animal, not necessarily, that perhaps is closer to what Phil was describing earlier, which is taken from an animal, but not necessarily meat itself, and could be even better. Is that, that's more what you're referring to with regards to the pig? Is that what you were?
No, I mean, even more basic, actually making a molecule of DNA that's exactly the same as the seed molecule of a pig DNA.
So how do you make it? You must start with something.
Yeah, you start with the atoms and the molecules.
Start with the amino acids.
DNA, make up the RNA, and then stick it into a cell, and it starts reproducing and making.
Okay, maybe.
DNA that makes it.
Right. So that would be even less. Okay, you're right. So that in a sense could be even better from this on, because here a lot of this it seems to be linked to the origin of the cells, whereas you're saying that the origin would be not kosher or not kosher, but just not animal altogether. Yeah,
I think your flying cars will come first.
All right, great. I'm looking forward.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes.
Sorry, I came a bit late, so you might have answered the first part of this question, but did you say in principle there are some who hold that you might be able to eat non-kosher animals?
I don't think anyone, I've not seen anyone practically argue that, but we did attempt to concoct such an argument.
Okay, well that makes my second half redundant, my word. Yeah.
I've not seen anyone actually suggest that.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's an interesting one. Very interesting one.